We were still on slide 13 last time, talking about valence. And I had already mentioned that for nonmetals, you can think of valence as being the number of bonds that that kind of atom is going to have to make in any molecule that it's part of. And the reason that that makes sense is because a covalent bond, which is the only kind of bond you find in molecules, is a pair of electrons, remember, one of which comes from each of the two participants. So for a specific single atom in a molecule, a bond that it participates in consists of one electron that that atom already had, right, plus one from the other atom that it's bonding to. So that means the atom gets credit for an additional electron, even though the bond is two electrons. The atom gets credit for one additional because one of those two in the pair it already had. Does that make sense? And that's why the valence means that number of bonds is going to satisfy that atom if it has that many bonds, which is practically the number of steps from the right edge, as I was saying. So that's why oxygen, if two oxygen atoms form a molecule, as you see here, they're going to do that by sharing four overall electrons, which gives credit for an additional two to each of the two atoms. This is a double covalent bond, but it counts the same as two single covalent bonds. Oxygen in any molecule it's a member of is going to be making two total bonds, either two singles or one double, because its valence is two, which you can see in slide 14. This table just gives you different ways to represent covalent structures. Now, molecules are covalent structures, meaning that the bonding between the things that in those structures is covalent rather than ionic. Ionic structures are always compounds. In other words, you can't have two ions of the same type bond together. Why is that? Two ions of the same element, why would they not bind together? Because the charge is the same, right? It's they're both positive or they're both negative. They would repel each other, not bond. So that means if you're going to have an ionic bond, you're always going to involve two different elements, one a metal and one a nonmetal, and therefore the final product is always a compound. When you're building a molecule, though, which is a covalent structure, it can be either an element still, like an oxygen molecule, that's still pure oxygen, even though it's a molecule made of multiple atoms, it's just that they're both oxygen, or it can be a covalent compound, like water. These top two, hydrogen molecule, oxygen molecule, those are elemental molecules. Water, though, is a covalent compound because it involves two different kinds of atoms. But once again, oxygen has a valence of two, and therefore it has to be making two bonds in that molecule it's part of. In this case, it's two single covalent bonds that add up to two. Hydrogen always forms one bond because its valence is one. Carbon has a valence of four, which we'll talk much more about in a different chapter, which means any molecule it's part of, it's going to have to be making four total bonds. It can be four single bonds, two double bonds, or a triple bond and a single bond. They all add up to four. Now to 15. This is water again. And now that we're looking at an isolated molecule, let me explain again why this is different from a formula unit or an ionic compound. Remember I said that molecules, the word molecule does not apply to ionic compounds. And that's because a molecule not only is covalent by definition, and ionic compounds don't have covalent bonds, but also, a molecule is a defined size. just like this water molecule. You can't just keep adding oxygens and hydrogens and have them all covalently bond to each other to make it arbitrarily big like you can a crystal of salt. It's this size. So when you have a sample of water, you have trillions and trillions of these, but they're all individual molecules. They're not hooked together covalently, like a salt would, because ions attract other ions of the opposite charge in all directions. Okay. So this is a molecule because it's covalent. It's a covalent structure. But now we need to subdivide that subdivision. We talked about chemical bonds, right? Which are the bonds that result in new substance. That's a major subset of overall bonds. And then within chemical bonds, we subdivided that into ionic and covalent bonds. We've already been through all of that. Now we're going to subdivide covalent bonds because there are two major categories of covalent bonds. And those categories are polar and nonpolar covalent bonds. That pretty much sucks. Obviously, you could tell from the words that these are opposite in some way. One's polar and one's not polar. The word polar is used a lot in science for various reasons. Polarity, or something being polar, simply means that there's something that's drastically different about two ends of that thing, whatever it is. Like the north and south pole of the globe are different from each other. Polar does not necessarily have anything to do with charge, but that's one example of there being a difference from one end to the other. And that's true for covalent bonds. So what makes a polar covalent bond polar is that there is an unequal sharing of electrons. So keep in mind, any covalent bond, whether it's polar or nonpolar, by definition of being covalent, the electrons are being shared by the two atoms. Otherwise, it wouldn't be covalent. But just like in real life, a sharing situation doesn't have to be an equal sharing, right? One of the two participants can hog whatever is being shared. And that's what happens in a polar covalent bond. Yes, there is a pair of electrons that's being shared by each of the two atoms, and therefore those two electrons spend some time around each of the two atoms. Otherwise it wouldn't be covalent. But an unequal sharing means that shared pair of electrons is spending more time around one of the two atoms than it is around the other atom. And think about what's being shared here. It's electrons, which are negatively charged particles. So if those electrons are spending more time around one end of the bond, which means one of the two atoms, then that end that is featuring those electrons more often than not is going to be made slightly negative because those electrons are negative. And the other end, which isn't going to have those electrons near it as often, is going to be slightly positive. Because the protons at that end are still there, but there aren't electrons as often to counteract the protons. Well, that doesn't happen in a nonpolar bond. A nonpolar bond is one in which the two atoms equally share the pair. And therefore, the electrons spend equal amounts of time at each end, and the two ends aren't different with respect to charge. Now, notice that I said a partial charge is featured on the two ends of a polar covalent bond. It's not a full charge like an ion. An ionic bond features a full charge, right? Because an ionic bond creates two ions. And each of those two ions is fully charged, either positive 1 or positive 2 or more, or negative 1 or negative 2 or more. Those are full charges, integer values. It's not happening here, though, because the electrons are not there all of the time, like they are when they've been transferred from one to the other in an ionic bond. And we denote that using the lowercase Greek delta. Uppercase Greek delta is the equilateral triangle. This is the lowercase version, a little d. And so delta minus means partially negative, because that's where the electrons are more often. Delta positive means partially positive. So not a full positive 1 or negative 1 charge, partial charge, though. All right, that's the distinction between a polar covalent bond and a nonpolar covalent bond. And molecules, which are made out of covalent bonds in general, can therefore be classified as either polar molecules or nonpolar molecules, depending on what kind of covalent bonds make up that molecule. Water is the overall molecule. There are two bonds in it. Each individual bond is polar, and therefore the entire water molecule can also be called polar. And you wouldn't exist without that fact, and no other organisms would exist. So it's impossible to overstate the importance of that to biology, which is why we're heading into a chapter that's all about the specialness of water. And that specialness springs from the fact that it's a polar molecule, which I'll explain as we get to that. But why is it that a covalent bond would form one way versus the other? Why would it be polar? Why would it be nonpolar? And it's not just random. The bond between oxygen and hydrogen in water, there's two of them, but I'm looking at just one of them. That bond is always going to be polar. It's never going to be nonpolar. So the question is, why would the sharing between two atoms of electrons be unequal? Well, this has to do with a property that any given atom has called electronegativity. So any given atom on the periodic table, any element in other words, has a specific value for electronegativity. Electronegativity, though, is a tendency for that atom to keep electrons for itself. You can think of it, in a sense, as greediness with respect to electrons. And the higher the numerical value of electronegativity, the more highly attractive that kind of atom is for electrons. And therefore, if an atom with a high electronegativity is involved in a covalent bond, yes, it will be sharing, but that high greediness means that they want to hog the electrons more than an atom that has a lower electronegativity. Now, electronegativity is a numerical indication of how much that kind of atom wants to keep electrons for itself. Now, when we look at the periodic table, the trend is not perfect, but in general, electronegativity values are low for elements in the lower left, and then they go up diagonally as you go to the upper right, except for the noble gases. Noble gases don't want any more electrons, right? They're happy already. But notice what's up in that upper right-hand corner. Fluorine and oxygen have the highest electronegativities of all elements. Fluorine has the highest, but oxygen's right pretty close. Now, consider the water molecule. Two bonds, but we can talk about just one of them because they're identical bonds. Each bond is between an oxygen and a hydrogen. I just told you that the value for electronegativity for oxygen is very high, much higher than the value for hydrogen. When they strike their deal, then, to share two electrons, oxygen is going to try to hog the electrons and be successful at that hogging. So even though the shared pair does spend some time around both, otherwise it wouldn't be a covalent bond, they're going to spend a lot more time around the atom that has the higher electronegativity. And that's why it is a polar covalent bond. In any polar covalent bond, there has to be a disparity and unequal values, and a pretty big difference in values for the electronegativities of those two atoms. And it's always going to be that the higher electronegative atom is going to have the electrons more often, and therefore there's going to be a slightly negative charge at that end where the electrons are more often. Does all of this make sense? If not, stop me. Because if you don't stop me, I'm going to assume that it does make sense. Okay. Let's consider an oxygen molecule. O2 that we've already looked at. Is that a polar or nonpolar molecule? It is nonpolar, and why is that? Why is it equal sharing in an oxygen molecule? It's the same what? Yes, it is, but why does that mean that it's going to be equal sharing?
Because they'll bring the same amount of electrons. And they'll have the same electron.
Yeah, oxygen still, in an oxygen molecule, oxygen is still just as greedy as it is in water, right? Has the same high electronegativity, but so does the other oxygen. So they're both trying to hog it, and no one wins. And therefore, the shared pair ends up spending equal time near both of the two oxygen atoms. So whenever you have a covalent bond joining two of the same element, two atoms of the same element, that's always going to be nonpolar. It's also possible, though, for two different atoms, even if they don't have identical values of electronegativity, if it's very close, then we'll classify that as a nonpolar as well, because it's almost exactly 50-50 split of time between each of the two atoms that these electrons spend. All right? But oxygen is very much higher than hydrogen, and you see hydrogen and oxygen in a lot of molecules, especially biomolecules. And water is no exception to that. Okay, so in 16, we see another water molecule, but we also see an ammonia molecule, an NH3. By the way, notice that nitrogen, as you can tell by looking at how far N is from the right edge, has a valence of 3 because it has 5 valence electrons, right? And therefore needs 3 more, therefore it's going to make 3 bonds. Ammonia is a good indication of that. It's making 3 individual covalent bonds with 3 different hydrogens. But anyway, nitrogen doesn't have as high an electronegativity as oxygen, but it's right by oxygen, and so it's also high compared to hydrogen. And so also NH bonds, just like OH bonds, are polar. And ammonia overall is therefore a polar molecule. Now there's nothing special about water and ammonia in this example. They just happen to be used as examples. But whenever you have molecules that are polar come close together, and this can be true of different polar molecules like you see here, or two water molecules or two ammonia molecules. Anytime you have multiple polar molecules in close proximity, even though they stay separate molecules and will not form chemical bonds with each other, they will form what is called a hydrogen bond. They're called hydrogen bonds because hydrogen is so often involved technically it doesn't have to be involved, but it just is because there's so many hydrogens. And hydrogen has a pretty low electronegativity, so it's just about anything that hydrogen is bonded to covalently is going to be pulled. I shouldn't say just about everything. A lot of things are. All right? So anyway, that's why it's called a hydrogen bond. But this hydrogen bond that you're seeing here is not a chemical bond. So this is an example of a bond that isn't in the big set called chemical bonds, because this does not permanently hook these things together and create new stuff. You'll still have water and ammonia separately. They're still their own molecules. But because of these partial charges, due to the fact that they're polar molecules, because of the polar covalent bonds, there will be a slight attraction between them for the same reason that there is a strong attraction between ions. They are charged oppositely. It's just very small charges. It matters, though. Even though it's a tiny attraction, it matters because a tiny attraction is more than no attraction at all. And therefore, when they get close to each other, they, even though it's not magnetism, it kind of acts like little, they act like little magnets and swivel around so that the partially negative end of one polar molecule will match up to the partially positive end of the other molecule. And that gives the whole population a little bit more order than there would be if you had a population of non-polar molecules, like oxygen. When you have a sample of oxygen, you have quadrillions of oxygen molecules, but they're just bouncing off of each other. They're not attracted to each other because they're all non-polar. All right? So that's what hydrogen bonds are. They're not only very weak, but they're also, I mean, they're easily broken because they're weak. They're also transient. They don't last very long simply because these things are moving. And so they'll be broken pretty easily, just like when you move a magnet past another magnet. You can kind of feel the attraction, but it's not going to stay there because you're going to keep moving it. 17. This slide tries to explain some of the geometry that you see in molecules. We've already looked at water several times, and when we look at these ball and stick models or these space filling models, you've always seen it so far as a bent molecule. You never see it as oxygen in the middle and two hydrogens, one on each end. And you might think, well, seems like it would make more sense symmetry-wise for the hydrogens to be at opposite ends. But that doesn't happen because you have to keep in mind that there are shared electrons and there are unshared electrons. The oxygen atom has how many valence electrons? How many total electrons does oxygen have? How could you find that out? How many total electrons? Eight. Because it has eight protons, right? That's what makes it oxygen. It has eight protons. If it's an atom, it therefore has eight electrons. How many valence electrons? No.
No, tell me the way it is from being official.
That's also not true. How many valence electrons does oxygen have?
Two.
No.
Six.
Six. That's why its valence is two. Valence is not necessarily the same as the number of valence electrons. It happens to be, just by coincidence, for hydrogen, it has one valence electron and it also has a valence of one. Oxygen has six valence electrons and therefore its valence is 8 minus 6, which is 2. Okay. So, the six valence electrons that oxygen has, if we draw an electron dot diagram, would be, we would have O representing the nucleus. We have 6 electrons that we need to put in that valence shell. And in an electron dot diagram, it's only valence electrons that you represent. The other ones that are deeper, you don't care about. You have 6. And you have 4 orbitals to fill around here, right? Because shell 2 consists of 4 orbitals. So you start putting each individual electron in its own orbital until you run out of orbitals. That's 4 dots. You still have 2 more. Then you have to start pairing them up until you are done with your electrons. So this shows you that oxygen has 4 electrons that result that are exist as 2 pairs. And those are not going to be involved in sharing. Those are going to remain the property of oxygen. Go ahead.
I have a question. Since people only have 2, you said there could be triple bonds.
Right.
What does that do to the shape of the atom?
Well, the fact that I'm drawing these on opposite sides doesn't really have anything to do about the shape, really.
Yeah.
So.
I was talking about it because like, they have like the 4 of them orbitals and they're all like trying to keep away from each other.
Yeah, it is true that orbitals hybridize and they change their shape because of that when they're involved in bonding. And I was trying to not mention that. I'm glad you noticed that, but it's really more important in a chemistry class than in here, which is why I just don't have time to explain hybridization, but that's what it's called if you ever want to look it up. Okay, but anyway, these 2 pairs of electrons are always going to be with oxygen. They're not going to be covalently shared. It's these unpaired ones that need to be shared so that another electron for each of those can be shared from the other thing to fill that orbital. That's what gives the stability. So another oxygen would be like that, and these would be the ones that get shared as a double bond. Well, anyway, in water, oxygen still has those 2 pairs. They're just not shown in this model. And then it has 2 electrons that are involved in the 2 bonds themselves. Electrons are all negative, right? Negatives repel each other. So if you have 4 pairs of electrons, 2 that are shared and 2 that are shared and 2 that are unshared, those 4 pairs are trying to get away from each other. And the best way to do that on a sphere is to go to 4 corners of a tetrahedron, a 4-sided pyramid shape. To you gaming nerds, it's the 4-sided die. All right? That's maximally spaced apart, these 4 corners. Well, this model, the space-filling model, doesn't show you that, but those 2 of those corners are occupied by those pairs that are always with oxygen. They're at 2 corners. The other 2 corners are occupied by the bonds. And that angle is exactly the angle you would have if you went from 1 corner of the 4-sided die to the very middle of the plastic. That's why it's always an angle. And in methane, what you have is the same pyramid shape, the same tetrahedron shape, but carbon is forming 4 bonds. So all 4 of its corners are involved in sharing. There's a hydrogen atom at each of those 4 corners. That's why it has its shape. Now to 18. Shape is a big deal when it comes to molecules, especially more complex molecules. What we're looking at here are a couple examples of signal molecules, which can also be called chemical signals. Signals are important in organisms because they cause things to happen that wouldn't happen if the signal were not present. It's a way for there to be communication between cells or tissues within an organism. And a chemical signal can be categorized not depending on what kind of chemical it is, but on how it's produced as either a drug, which is an exogenous signal, or it can be an endogenous signal. The gen here, like in generate, means create, or genesis. Exo means out. Endo means in. So an exogenous signal is something that the organism doesn't produce in its own body. But if taken into the body, it can act as a chemical signal. That's what drugs are. Drugs are things that we have to put into our bodies. We don't make them in our own cells. Endogenous signals, though, we do make in our bodies, and they operate as signals. So they operate, they can operate the same way, but that's the distinction. Exogenous are things that occur outside of the body. And we have an example of each of these categories. On the left is natural endorphin. That's an endogenous signal. We make that in our body. And among other things, endorphin gives us pain relief. Gives us other things as well, feeling of pleasantness, but it's pain relief is one. Morphine is a drug. But it also, as you probably know, can give pain relief as well. The reason that they operate the same way is because of something important in general about signals, chemical signals. No chemical signal will ever have any effect unless and until that chemical signal, whatever it is, binds to a receptor molecule, either in or on the surface of a cell. Because if there is no binding, then there is no change that's made. A cell can't tell that a signal is there unless the signal binds to a receptor. And we see a receptor here, which is a protein. Proteins do all the important jobs, like I've said. One job is to serve as receptors. This blue protein, which is embedded in the membrane of a cell, has just the right shape on part of it to accept the corresponding shape of endorphin. And if endorphin has been released into the bloodstream and is reaching the cells of the body, no cell will respond. No cell will know that endorphin's even there unless that cell happens to have the right kind of receptor with just the right shape to accept it, kind of like a lock and a key fit. By the way, the reason that this results in a change is that when a signal does bind to a receptor, that results in a change in shape of the receptor. We call that a conformational change. The shape of a protein is called the conformation. And when that change in shape happens, that causes other things to result as a consequence, and so on. There can be multiple steps of consequences. But that's why nothing's going to happen if you don't bind the signal to the receptor to begin with. Well, endorphin, as you see here, is a pretty complex molecule. But this is the business end of the molecule that's shown in the black box. Because that's the part that actually fits into the receptor molecule. If you think about a key that is necessary for a lock, it's not real. Doesn't matter what the head of the key is shaped as. You can get one with a dog head or whatever, right? It's the other end that you put into the lock that the shape matters for. Well, this is why morphine, which isn't really very much like endorphin overall, still has the same effect as endorphin, because this part is enough shaped like the black box part of endorphin for it also to fit into the same kind of receptors. And it will relieve pain just like natural endorphin does. So shape is very important in molecules for several reasons. We'll get into more examples later. That's another chapter.